Dr. Marcellino D'Ambrosio with us now from the Crossroads Initiative. You can find him and his pilgrimages online at dritaly.com. Good morning, Doc. Welcome back.
Good morning, Anna. It's good to be back.
It's good to have you. And Ignatius of Antioch, his feast day is October 17th. He was the second bishop of Antioch. And before we get to his importance in church history, can you just give us a sense of how important his diocese was in his day?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, in those days, they weren't called dioceses quite yet, but the church of the city of Antioch was amazingly important. It was just up the coast. If you go to, and you're in Israel, we on our pilgrimage, we always go to the seaport of Caesarea, where Herod and Pontius Pilate lived, and Paul was in prison. And if you go up that seacoast, and you go past Lebanon, then you hit Antioch. And Antioch is one of the three most important cities in the Roman Empire at this point in time. So it's no wonder that Paul and Barnabas used it as their missionary base. It was in the city of Antioch that followers of Jesus were called Christians for the first time. And that makes a lot of sense to me because Christian means anointed one. And those guys were anointed for mission. They began sharing the gospel with everybody, with Gentiles. And then, you know, all the books we have in the New Testament, we know a lot of the names of Paul's letters. Well, Paul left from Antioch to go to those towns where he wrote those letters, to the Ephesians, for example, you know, to the Galatians. So it's a pretty important place. And not only did Paul and Barnabas live there, those are two pretty great apostles, but Peter was there for a while. So the church there is heir to the tradition of Peter, Paul, and Barnabas. And there's only one bishop between those apostles and Ignatius. That's how close Ignatius is to that apostolic tradition.
Wow, very cool. And you mentioned Paul and his writings, his letters. Ignatius has a bunch of letters that he wrote as well that we still have today. Isn't that right?
Yes. And the letters weren't just written in leisure. You know, he's sitting in his residence writing leisurely letters. The letters were written in great crisis because persecution could happen any point, any time. After the time of Paul and Peter's death, it was a capital crime in the Roman Empire to be a Christian. And it wasn't a systematic empire-wide thing at first. It was sporadic. It broke out. And it broke out in Antioch. And the bishop is caught, and he's a big fish. They don't want to just kill him in Antioch. They want to send him to Rome so he can die for the amusement of the emperor there. So he's chained to a squad of brutal soldiers who abuse him, and he is marched overland through Turkey. He's walking with these guys, chained. And on the west coast of Turkey, Christian delegations from Christian churches come out to meet him and kiss his chains and honor him. There's no persecution going on at that point there, so they take that risk. And after they leave, he goes to the next city, he writes letters back to them. So he's writing this as he's chained to soldiers on his way to death. And it gives us an awesome insight into what is a bishop right after the apostles dealing with, but also what is a martyr thinking about? How is a martyr who's about to die for Christ think about his witness? And we don't have anything from the early church that's quite like this. It's really a treasure trove, these seven short letters.
Well, I know that he was sort of speaking out against some of the heresies that were going on in that day. And as we've been learning from Dr. Jim Papandrea as well, that there was kind of a spectrum of belief on Jesus and whether there was a focus on his humanity and whether his humanity was more important or his divinity, and whether his divinity was more important to the, you know, detriment of the other, right? And so I know that he taught both on the divinity and the humanity of Jesus. Can you start first with what he had to say about the divinity?
Yeah, well, the very first thing I want to say, Annie, is that heresy means choice. It means a one-sided choice of one side of the truth to the neglect of the other. That's literally what the word heresy means in Greek. And so we find that it's pretty hard to hold it all together. It's a challenge to our human mind. That's why we call everything having to do with the faith a mystery, because it's more than we can absorb and we can easily grasp. Mm-hmm. So who is Jesus? He is both God and man. Now, I think this is important also to stop and say this. There are people like the Jehovah's Witnesses who allege that the Catholic Church started with Constantine, and the divinity of Christ was taught by Constantine. Now, Constantine is 300, and we're talking 312 is when he decreed that Christianity is legal. So we're now, Ignatius is about 112. So 200 years before Constantine, we got to check out this hypothesis that the evil Catholics under Constantine perverted the gospel and invented the idolatrous Trinity and all that crap. So if, now we look at Ignatius. There are a group of Judaizers. There are Christians who are just the same kind of folks Paul was dealing with, the Judaizers who wanted to hold to the law, insist on keeping the law, and they had a real hard time with the divinity. So they're minimizing Jesus' divinity and treating him like he's just a great prophet. And Ignatius says constantly he's talking about Jesus as God. In the New Testament, some people say there's not a lot of places where it says that Jesus is God, the word God. Well, in Ignatius' short seven letters, written only a few years after the death of the last apostle, Jesus is called God 16 times. He talks about God's blood. He is unbelievable. He says that Jesus is timeless, uncreated. Very, very clear that Jesus is not created before everything else. Jesus, the Word of God that's made flesh in Jesus is timeless, the uncreated eternal God. That's what Ignatius says. Pretty amazing. This anticipates the creed. Again, Nicaea comes after Constantine by 200 years.
Wow. Now, as you also said, though, this is not to dismiss the humanity of Jesus. He also wrote about that.
Exactly. And see, you have Jews who have a hard time with the divinity because of the great stress on only one God, okay? Mm-hmm. Then you have Greeks who, everybody's a god. You know, the emperor's a god, Hercules is a god. So that's not a problem. The real problem for them is, how could God get messed up with yucky flesh? Ugh. I mean, flesh is, it smells, people can bleed, it's very yucky. So for the Greeks, matter was evil, and salvation meant getting away from the body and getting away from this world and becoming spiritual. So they minimized Jesus' birth and death, and they basically explained it away and said that it was an appearance. This becomes a full-blown heresy down the road. Gnosticism, about 50 years after this or 40 years, really is very serious about this. But right now it's a tendency that it's not organized, but we see it, and Ignatius sees it, and he strikes out against it. And so he says things like this: Jesus Christ, really born, who really died on the cross under Pontius Pilate, who really rose. You hear an echo of the kernel of what later becomes the Apostles' Creed, the Nicene Creed, but he puts these reallys in to emphasize that Jesus' humanity is not a sham. He actually calls this. He says, people who say Jesus' humanity is just a sham, just an appearance, they're a sham. So he's pretty serious about this. And he's also serious about the fact that these people deny the Eucharist. And the reason they deny that the Eucharist is a real body and blood of Christ is because they deny Jesus really had a body. And so he's very insistent on the reality of the Eucharist and how it's not just a symbol, but he connects that to the true humanity of Christ. Very interesting.
Dr. D'Ambrosio, how did St. Ignatius of Antioch die?
Ignatius, we don't actually know for sure, because Ignatius, after his seventh letter, vanishes. But what he's expecting, what he's sentenced to die, how he's sentenced to die, is to be thrown to the wild beasts in the arena. And Ignatius writes to the Church of Rome. He writes seven letters, and he's giving, six of them are to people in what's now Turkey, right around where he's traveling. And he's giving his last shot. This is his best shot now before he dies, to try to bring them to orthodoxy, to holiness, to zeal. To Rome, he writes and says, guys, I'm coming. I'm sentenced to death. Please don't interfere. Because you have so many martyrs. You've been blessed with so many people who've died as martyrs. Don't be greedy. Let this poor Syrian die also for Christ. And, if I come to you and in my weakness I change my mind and to ask you to get me out and get me free, don't listen to me. It's just an amazing letter.
Nice, nice. Wow. Well, he was martyred many centuries ago. now. And you'd think that perhaps our Middle Eastern Christian brothers and sisters would, in more modern times, have a much easier situation on their hands. And yet, that is not the case today, is it?
It's not. I just read yesterday about 12 martyrs. It seems that they're evangelical Christians. And they were martyred because they were in ISIS territory. And not only did they become Christian, they were Muslims who became Christian, but they insisted that they had to share their faith. That's why they were caught, and they died. And this is right in the area where good old Ignatius was captured and sent to Rome. So, you know, over the past 100 years, we probably had more martyrs than any in the 19 previous centuries. So it's amazing. And the attitude of Ignatius is instructive. The attitude of the New Testament is instructive. If you read Revelations 12:12, yeah, we should be angry about ISIS. This is true. It's a horrible thing. But on the other hand, we should rejoice that our brothers and sisters have the courage and the love to give their lives for Christ. And we need to celebrate that and realize that that is how the church spread in the early days. A comfortable church is not going to attract anybody. It's the blood of the martyrs that's the seed of the church. Mm-hmm. So we should pray for them, but we should also, you know, we should rejoice and not just say, ain't it awful. We should rejoice and pray for their families and pray that those who are left would continue to be strong and that we would be courageous and get off our duff and share the gospel here in this country where it's not at the cost of our life, at least not yet.
Well, speaking of getting off our duffs, I know that you are passionate about solidarity with our persecuted fellow Christians and that you really consider your pilgrimages to this area of the world as one way to show that solidarity.
Absolutely. I want to say that, you know, unlike Syria, Israel and the Palestinian territories, we don't go to Gaza. But when it comes to Bethlehem and when it comes to Jericho, when it comes to Israel, these territories are very, very safe. However, the Christians here are beleaguered. The Palestinians used to be, until 1967, 30% Christian. And because of difficulties with their own citizenship inside of Israel, because of difficulties with increasingly challenging Muslim neighbors, you know, many have had to leave. And so when we go to the Holy Land, we meet Christians from the land who are staying and are witnessing to Christ. And our presence there gives them moral support, spiritual support, and also financial support. All the people who staff our pilgrimage on the ground over there, the restaurants we eat in, the hotels we stay in, and by doing that, we're keeping Christian families in the Holy Land, and we're meeting them. And it's a beautiful encounter. We have one traveling with us all the time who's sharing from his heart his experience of the Gospels. As one who's lived in the land and his family's lived in the land probably since the time of Jesus, it's an amazing perspective to get.
What is it like for your pilgrims to meet these Christians who live in the Holy Land?
It is a great surprise, and it's one of the highlights of their trip. They just, first of all, didn't even think that there would be Palestinian Christians. You know, we just tend to have this image in this country of Palestinians as Muslim and as radical. And so, first of all, they're overwhelmed by the incredible hospitality and the beauty of the spirit of the people. And then they're inspired, and then they're bonded. You know, my people who go on the pilgrimages often keep in touch with our guide through Facebook. And there's beautiful sharing that goes on. He shares spiritual goods, and many times our people will give gifts to his family of four beautiful children. He's laboring really hard to send them to Catholic school. I mean, it's very difficult for Christians to actually own a home in the Holy Land, and that's one of the things we're helping this family to do. They also meet a shopkeeper whose grandfather discovered the Dead Sea Scrolls. So we actually go to the place where the Dead Sea Scrolls were kept. You know, after they left, they were taken from the desert. We hear the story from the horse's mouth, so to speak, you know, from the family that actually discovered them and their importance. So these are pretty amazing experiences for our people.
I would imagine so. And I mean, I know you've just talked about how safe it is for pilgrims to go to these areas of the Holy Land that you take them, but you have to really admire the courage of those who actually live there and stay there during this time in our history.
Absolutely. They're courageous people. And it really takes an act, a deliberate act, to stay there, because so many Christians have sought a better life by leaving. And, you know, oftentimes they get assistance in being able to leave. But quite frankly, you know, the Christians who are in the land, particularly those who are not Israeli citizens, who are living in Palestinian territory, it's a very complicated situation over there. But they don't have full rights from the Israeli government, and they take pressures sometimes from Muslim neighbors. So they kind of get it from multiple sides, this financial challenges. So it really takes a lot of courage and commitment to stay in the land and bear witness to Christ there.
Now, you go on pilgrimage to the Holy Land, generally speaking, right around Christmas and also during the Easter season, right?
Yeah, my favorite times are right after Christmas and right after Easter, because the crowds are down, the weather is good, but we're still in the holiday season, celebrating from the 27th of December to January 6th. We're celebrating Christmas in Bethlehem while the Christmas lights are still up. During the octave, we're bringing in the new year in Jerusalem. We're sailing the Sea of Galilee, and it's spring-like weather in January in Galilee, so that's beautiful. But then we go right after Easter, and we're singing Alleluia at the tomb, you know, where we're celebrating the resurrection on top of Mount Tabor. So it's pretty awesome to be there during these special seasons.
Gives me chills just thinking about it, being able to have that opportunity as a Christian to be right there in the times that it happens. You know, I mean, it just sounds incredible, Dr. D'Ambrosio. If listeners are interested in heading on a pilgrimage to you or getting any of the resources that you have at the Crossroads Initiative, where can they get more information?
Well, they just go to dritaly.com. That's dritaly.com. And it brings up the homepage. And at the very top, there's a menu that has pilgrimages. Just click on that. You'll get the general pilgrimage page, and you can navigate to either the winter or the spring Holy Land pilgrimage.
Awesome.
And as of next week, there'll also be a pilgrimage to Italy available on that website. The pilgrimage section of the site is pretty interesting. I think people will love it.
Very cool. We'll have it linked at sunrisemorningshow.com. Thanks so much, Doc.
It's great being with you. Thanks so much, Annie.